Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Negotiation Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Embley. And on today's show, I am pleased to welcome back once again, Ray Ma, founder of TechBuzz China and one of the most trusted English language voices on China's technology sector. She is back to break down everything happening in China's tech landscape, from DeepSeek to humanoid robots. Ray runs in-person tech immersion trips to China for investors and executives, giving her a ground-level view of what's actually being built and deployed, not just what's being announced. In this episode, she shares her biggest takeaways from recent trips and what surprised her to what confirmed what she already suspected about China's AI and hardware trajectory. She walks us through the humanoid robot sector, who the leading Chinese companies are, what the realistic near-term use cases look like, and whether Americans will ever be able to buy Chinese-made robots. She unpacks Alibaba's Taobao and Quen integration, Tencent's quieter but consequential AI strategy, DeepSeek's latest moves, and the OpenClaw explosion. She also gives her read on NVIDIA export controls, whether they're working, and how Chinese companies are adapting. Ray also weighs in on the X debate about quality of life in lower-tier Chinese cities, assesses the broader U.S.-China AI competition, including the talent landscape, and gives her takes on Jipu and Minimax as publicly traded AI plays. If you want to understand where China tech is headed and what it means for the rest of the world, this is the episode to listen to. Enjoy.
Recently, there's been a flood of humanoid hand companies. So because ultimately, a lot of the things that you do, at least specifically in a manufacturing setting, you really, like, why do you need a head or eyes or, you know, shoulders or legs, right? You kind of just need hands. And the reason why you need hands is because a lot of the equipment is designed for human hands. And therefore, if you want a very, very flexible supply chain, meaning that you want a supply chain that is, I don't mean like flexible supply chain as an inventory. I mean, if you want like a flexible factory floor where you're not just manufacturing one item or even a few types of items, but you're trying to manufacture like a wider breadth of things, then you actually want smaller machines and smaller robots, right, that can move around and that can change what they're doing very easily.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to the Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Ray, welcome back to the Negotiation Podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me. Yeah, good to see you, Todd.
Yeah, this must be your third or fourth time, something like that. I don't know. I feel like once you get to five, we'll send you like a nice golden blazer.
I don't remember, to be honest.
It's going to be like going into the, you know, NFL Hall of Fame and you get like this nice gold yellow jacket to wear. Where does the podcast find you today?
I am in the Bay Area in, San Francisco Bay Area, California, but I am heading to China in about 48 hours. So
is it perchance for a TechBuzz of China immersion trip?
Yeah, for several. We have we partnered with a friend of mine to do youth trips. So we have our inaugural cohort where we bring 10 to 18 year olds and their parents, chaperones, to China for a week to see some of the frontier technology up and close. So, you know, like automated warehouses, EV factories, going to see the humanoid robots, of course, do some hands-on, you know, 3D printing, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to talk about all of that. Tell us a little bit about where this came from. What was the inspiration? What is the kind of the mantra or the modus operandi of these tech immersion trips?
Oh, for the children? For the children was because we took enough investors to China and they were like, oh, I actually think it's really important that my kids see this.
Well, even back like from the original ones.
Oh, it was just because someone reached out and said, I'm an investor. They don't actually invest in China. This is back in 2019. It was because they said, even though we don't invest in China, all of our holdings, and they were kind of consumer heavy at that point, face a lot of either competition from China or supply chains in China or have a big market in China. I remember very clearly at the time, the investor was like, I have a large holding in Tiffany's. And did you know Tiffany's has 1/3 of their revenue coming from China? So, yeah. So they wanted to go see and see the market for themselves and understand the competitive landscape.
What cities do you typically visit?
You know, we've done a mix, but I think now it's too much work to go to some of the second and third tier cities. We have gone down to even to a fourth tier city again to see some manufacturing. I took execs to see new energy. And if you want to see manufacturing, sometimes they are in the fourth tier cities. But we typically try to stick to two out of the three big cities. So Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen. Any, 5 days, pick two of those. And then maybe one other in the middle. We tend to go to Hefei a lot. It's kind of in the middle. And then it has one of the most advanced EV factories. It's a little slightly easier to schedule than some of the other ones we have access to. So.
What about like Guangzhou or Hangzhou?
Yeah, we've been to all of those cities. We've been to, I think, 9 cities in the past 5 trips. It just depends on the theme. And because, we used to have some open trips. So I think now we just have enough demand that we're only going to do bespoke trips. So basically groups come to us fully formed already. They have a unified agenda. And then we design something really tailored to what they're looking for.
Well, you never go to Dalian, my old China hometown?
No.
Why not?
No.
Okay.
Oh, all right. There. Not frontier tech. Yeah.
No.
There's great stuff there, but not frontier tech.
Yeah. Seafood though.
Seafood. Right. Yeah.
Sea cucumbers.
And great and beautiful buildings and history and all that. Yeah.
Oh, it's got some history. Yeah. Let me tell you, like the whole Russian-Japanese war stuff is
right.
That was a big place for all of that stuff. Okay. So, what trips do you have coming up, and why?
Yeah, we have the youth one, like I said.
Oh, the youth one, yeah.
Yeah, we have another one that is just generically frontier tech with a bunch of policymakers, some AI researchers. Just people from all over the globe who've they're part of a group and then they wanted to see what's on the ground. So we'll have some interesting conversations and do some company visits. And we'll probably also attend one of the conferences as well. That's in August.
What would you maybe do a little bit different, or how do you cater to and specialize a trip when you're taking youth?
We work with, there has to be a lot more visual, right? They're not looking to talk to management. We try to be a little bit more inspirational. We have a segment or two where we either get a professor or current new grads or graduate students to come and talk, because I think it's really important too. For me, for example, I've been out of college for 20 years. I don't know what people are studying in, grad school programs or college right now. And what did they do to prepare? And what are they thinking about their job prospects? Right. And what are they seeing are the opportunities in STEM or some of the dangers or whatnot, right? So it's just like a chance to get up and close and personal for our youth trip. It's in Beijing. So we have some Tsinghua students just joining us and sharing. And I think, to be honest, I don't know what the teens are going to ask, but I know their parents are going to have lots of questions.
Yeah, well, it is a two-sided marketplace in that regard, in that, your clients are the kids, but your customers are the parents, let's be honest.
Right, yeah, so. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, it's a self-selected group. It's very STEM heavy. So they're already doing whatever robotics competitions, and they're already thinking about careers in these companies. So It's just a way for them to get closer and say, hey, you know about, you know, Mag 7, but maybe there are some other companies or other industries that the US, for example, is not as strong in that you might consider. You know, have you thought about, you know, quantum computing or low altitude economy? We're visiting one of those, you know, companies. So that's less, I think the development along that axis is less extensive in the West.
It has not been 20 years. I know you went back and did a little MBA thing 10 years ago, didn't you? Didn't you go to INSEAD?
Yes, I did. At Tsinghua, actually. Oh, yeah. But yeah, since I've been in college, it's over 20 years, right? So.
All right, fine. Yeah. What is low altitude economy?
That's like the flying taxis, the, you know, passenger drones. So, for example, in China, actually, one of the reasons we go to Hefei is because there is currently the only site that has all three licenses required for flying, carrying commercial passengers in a flying taxi. It's just a 4-minute, 5-minute experience, but you can ride one.
Is it safe? I'd be nervous.
We have had people on our trips ride it, and they have had over 85,000 rides without incident. So, yeah.
Nice.
But, you know.
Okay.
You sign a waiver with the provider, not with us. So.
Yeah, I bet. Okay. Let's start with humanoid robots. They are everywhere in the China conversation right now. Talk to us about, and there's threefold. Now, if I need to remind you, I will, but. Who are the leading companies, Chinese companies in the space, most realistic near-term use cases? And will Americans actually potentially be able to buy Chinese-made robots? And last question is a lot of layers to it.
Yeah, I think right now, so we visit a bunch of these companies. I would say the leading ones in terms of deployments or, you know, manufacturing, Agibot is one. Unitree, obviously. There's one that's publicly listed called UBTech, actually. They're one of the older companies. They started off in service robots and robot dogs like everyone else, and now moved on to humanoids. They also have some, you know, factory pilots. There's like about supposedly like over 200 humanoid makers. I would say of those, you know, 20 of them have raised, let's call it over 50 million USD. So it's not that many that are sizable. There's a bunch of them, but, you know, the players that I think are going to stick around is really, you know, one or two dozen. And the use cases right now are very limited. So there are some in factory situations, but they're primarily doing sorting and picking or just moving things around or doing things like, you know, repetitive tasks like screwing things on. Agibot just did a live stream last month where they had, I think, a 5-day live stream of robots working on the quality assurance of tablets. And it was at a very large facility. It was at Longcheer, which is actually the largest OEM for smartphones in the world, ODM for smartphones in the world. So very significant player looking to automate some of this work. As for whether or not, you know, Americans can buy it. I mean, right now you can, but I don't know how much longer that'll last because it is a very... it is a technology that, you know, could be sitting in your home or sitting in your commercial settings and has high requirements on security and safety, right? So it really, we'll see. I didn't actually go into the use cases besides the factory pilots. What they're actually used in, which you can see some limited deployments in, is, I mean, honestly, right now they're largely largely on display as guides in high-end or retail settings or museums or selected like banks. They're really just standing there and not doing very much. So
what sectors? And because manufacturing can be almost all sectors, right? I mean, what sectors, as far as, let's talk like agriculture or aerospace or what have you, what do you think is going to be the first mass adopter to deploy humanoids, given the way the trends, the technology is headed?
Well, it's certainly not agriculture, because that's just not a very efficient, I think, and agriculture is already very mechanized. I think it is in the manufacturing sector for the places that we still have lots of human labor. That being said, recently there's been a flood of humanoid hand companies. So, because ultimately, a lot of the things that you do, at least specifically in a manufacturing setting, you really, like, why do you need a head or eyes or, you know, shoulders or legs, right? You kind of just need hands. And the reason why you need hands is because a lot of the equipment is designed for human hands. And therefore, if you want a very, very flexible supply chain, meaning that you want a supply chain that is, I don't mean like, you know, flexible supply chain as an inventory. I mean, if you want like a flexible factory floor where you're not just designing, you're not just manufacturing one item or even a few types of items, but you're trying to manufacture like a wider breadth of things, then you actually want smaller machines and smaller robots, right? That can move around and that can change what they're doing very easily. And for that, again, robots would make it easier. They can obviously work for longer, be much more precise, and need very little downtime. So hands might be sufficient. There's one company we talked to briefly that is already at 10,000 hands a month. And we asked them, so some of them are going on humanoids, but most of them actually are just going on arms and then are just, you know, doing things that humans would do, but you don't need the full body. You just need to attach it to arm.
Let's move on to Alibaba's recent integration of Quen directly into Taobao. What's your read on that move? What does it signal about where Chinese e-commerce is heading, if it gives a signal? And how is Alibaba thinking about its AI strategy, according to you?
So Alibaba is really redefining itself as an AI company. It has, you know, a very robust cloud business.
Is that smart?
Oh, I think so. I think it's very difficult to get a high valuation these days in any market, without private or public, without AI. Yeah. So, and it has all the pieces, right? They've been working on AI for a long time. They have the leading cloud business in China.
Yeah.
They have tons of enterprise relationships, right? They're not just the e-commerce company. They really are the Amazon equivalent, right? So they have every reason, I think, to, you know, go all in on AI, which is their current mantra. They obviously also have some like really good models that they've open sourced. I think like when it comes to putting their agents in, so AI agents specifically in their e-commerce, it is kind of working, but it's not working well enough, right? So everyone in China is doing that, by the way, because if you think about it, as soon as people figured out like AI agents and tool calls, right? So meaning that you're not just chatting, but like this AI is capable of calling upon other tools to complete real tasks for you, it just became very obvious that's what all apps are going to have to be like, because if you're not offering that level of intelligence, you really can't compete. So I think in China, what we are going to see a little bit faster than in the US, partly because, you know, Apple doesn't dominate the ecosystem. In China, you have a lot of smartphone manufacturers who are already putting in AI agents themselves on the smartphone layer. And then you also have all these super apps, right, that effectively do so many things, are kind of like the Apple ecosystem, right? WeChat being the main one, but even like Alipay also has all sorts of mini programs attached to it, right? So once these platforms start adding in AI agents, everything is going to become smart. And Taobao is one of the other apps that could do this and really make a difference in the consumer experience. I'm actually personally beta testing right now for the WeChat AI. I can definitely see that if it worked, I would be using it a lot.
Yeah.
It's just making your whole phone experience smarter. Like, why do I want to open up all these web pages, go to C-Trip and put in all these things if I can just, talk to my WeChat and say, book me the flight from Beijing to Shanghai.
Yeah, let's contrast with, Tencent's AI strategy. So for all intents and purposes, we just see that they've been a little quieter than Alibaba and Baidu in the AI race publicly. Clearly a lot going on. How do you see Tencent's approach to AI? Where do you think they're headed?
Big fan of Tencent, the company. I think they just have a different competitive position, right? So they don't have that. They have a cloud business, but it's not nearly as large. They have WeChat. That's kind of the crown jewel. They have a lot of users, but they have the opportunity to really push out consumer AI that is going to be very extremely good in that how many touch points they have with the average consumer in China specifically every day. I would say Alibaba is still kind of going after the enterprise model, and Tencent is, relatively speaking, more focused on just pushing AI into its own products. If you really think about it, if WeChat is a 1.4 billion user app. If people are really going to be using, AI in WeChat, like I said, that's really kind of replacing your phone, your entire phone operating system, and you have all sorts of sensitive information in it. Just like your own, like people have their. Whatever they do their tax returns on mini programs, right? Inside of WeChat, right? So all this very sensitive information, they need to be very, very careful how they're dealing with it. So I do understand why they've been a little bit slower. But I think once they are able to figure out exactly how to do this, and like I said, they are starting to, right? They're starting to test the AI agent on WeChat. Developers of mini programs can opt in into Tencent AI so that the AI agent can directly connect to your mini program and know how to operate it, be smart about it so it doesn't have to figure it out on the fly. All these things, I think that, the strategy is a good one, given that that's where their advantages are. But the main difference is Tencent's primarily throwing AI into their own products, and Alibaba's kind of selling the model and the cloud.
DeepSeek continues to be one of the most watched and talked about names in global AI. What's the latest update that you've heard about DeepSeek? As far as new releases, what they're working on, and how do you assess and position them in the broader AI race?
Yeah, we've talked to, I think, all the other major labs except DeepSeek. I would say, today they were, reported on as looking to build their own inference chips. No surprise there. I would say overall, they remain like I still call them tier one. Some people think they've fallen behind a little bit because, by the way, they have been working with domestic hardware, and that has slowed them down a little bit, right? Working with Huawei chips instead of, the restricted NVIDIA chips. But I think in the long run, that's actually going to pay off because we are seeing already that overall the semiconductor space in China, it's kind of like, I think it's stronger than even like Chinese people thought, or maybe especially Chinese people, because Chinese people, I think, were very bearish on the sector. But that the co-evolution, the software and hardware and everyone kind of working together in an integrated fashion, we see that Meituan has already launched a trillion parameter model that is trained on domestic chips only, which I think is faster than most people expected, because the inference stuff, that's much easier. The inference steps are much easier to make, but to be able to string together a domestic, presumably Huawei chips, and string a trillion parameter model, which is, you know, considered frontier today, that's very difficult. So for DeepSeek, they are one of the most active players in that hardware software co-evolution. And I think that they're going to continue to be doing very well because they also just raised $7 billion. And, you know, they have a very, very aggressive research strategy, and they're very, very focused on not being, you know, they don't want to be reliant on selling and marketing their products to survive, right? They want to keep the burn to just being focused on R&D and really being open source and pushing the frontier. So I personally am I'm a big fan. I hope their vision comes to pass, but they also have very stiff competition from other model labs.
How does DeepSeek compare to Jiapu or Minimax?
Yeah, they're all very different companies. Minimax is, many would say, less serious of an R&D powerhouse. Jiapu comes from, you know, Jiapu predates like most of these other companies in the sense that they're a 20-year-old lab. The co-founders are two professors that have been working together at Tsinghua on big models for a very long time and have published many, many papers together. So it's a very cohesive team. They have like this whole Tsinghua pipeline of talent, obviously the best STEM university in China. So they're all very different, I would say. I think DeepSeek's like you know, if I had to compare them versus Jiapu, they're not, they're more, we have a China AI Atlas that we built at, on our website. You can see where we track some of the news and stats on the companies and the models, and we call them cost curve rebels because they kind of are. They're very unconventional in how they go about solving these problems, whereas Jiapu is really like this kind of very, they're not conventional, but they're like more of a, what you expect of like this elite academics, right, into commercialization pipeline. Yeah. So those two, I would say right now, though, are two of the strongest teams in China right now, for sure.
Okay. Well, what are one or two others that you're kind of keeping an eye on?
I think Tencent is late to the game, but has done some really interesting things. They just released their new model.
Well, when you have money and data and a deployment vehicle like WeChat, I mean, I don't care how late you are.
Yeah, but they really rebuilt their team in the last 6 months. So that's really impressive, right?
Because because they'll get talent. That's the same thing for Alibaba. Like, to go into AI, not that hard. Like, who doesn't want to work? It's one of the strongest employers in China.
Well, yeah, AI is slightly different. I do think that AI researchers have a little bit it's a little bit more of a clubby society, if you know what I mean, where they have very strong opinions on who's going to get to AGI, right? Yeah, and whose strategies they want to, you know, whose leadership.
Where does this come from? Are they getting this at the education level at university, you know, from other Tsinghua professors, wherever they're studying? Why would they be taking as almost a class or an industry, a sector, you know, of talent, be looking at their professional career paths differently than others in tech?
Well, I mean, you have to consider that when you join a big tech company like Tencent, which is already worth hundreds of billions of dollars, you are kind of subject to the whims of the political realities of such a large conglomerate. But also, Tencent may, you know, or Alibaba or Meituan, whatever, may have lots of resources, but they're not necessarily up to you to
you're doing what they tell you to. Them.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So there are other considerations, whereas if you're an independent startup lab, and I'm just playing the devil's advocate here, mm-hmm, right? Because mm-hmm. if you're an independent lab, then yeah, you know, this is sort of your sole business, AI. There's no higher priority, you know, everyone's working on just the AI part. So all the resources are, maybe like your crazy experiments are not so crazy because everyone's just trying to find alpha, but only for the LLM. And of course, we've seen that companies like Jibu are now worth $100 billion, right? And it's $100 billion of wealth concentrated in across an employee base of only 1,000 people, whereas your Tencents and Alibabas have 100,000 employees. So I don't know how much shareholder value you need to create to get to see to be in the 3-comma club. So, but I think, commercial and, wealth considerations aside, it's really like a lot of people truly believe, are AI pilled for what it's worth in this field. You kind of have to be, right? Dedicating your whole career to it. And they want to be they want to be there when it happens, right?
So they want to be cutting edge. It sounds like they are just more independently, artistically minded than the average tech software graduate is the way I'm hearing it. And, nobody studies music to with the goal of being in a really great cover band.
Yeah, exactly. But I think with AI specifically and AGI, this definition's a little murky, but many people believe it's like they're like really close, right? Really upon the cusp. So if you truly believe that and you believe like there's some kind of finish line you can get to first, then and you believe you can be part of that group, right? Like the few hundred people that have a realistic shot at being whatever, having their names carved into human history as being the discoverers of AGI, that's why that's why people are picky. And by the way, everyone has a different story and a different belief into how it's going to happen. So for example, the Tencent AI lab lead, their new lead that they hired over 6 months ago, he believes that having access to really quality data is one of the key differentiators. And that's why he's at Tencent. That's his public story, at least. I don't know what he truly thinks, but hey, it's a plausible way to get to AGI. More quickly.
He probably didn't take a huge salary cut just to join Tencent, though.
Yeah, I don't.
let's talk to me about, and our listeners, about the OpenClaw explosion in China.
Yeah, that was at the beginning of the year. We wrote about it as well. The OpenClaw thing was really just because, honestly, because the model makers were pushing it, because it's really difficult to charge consumers for a chat experience. I mean, it's also difficult in the US, right? You just have slightly higher willingness to pay, but in China, that is almost non-existent. And so what you had was when agents popped up, and like I said, this whole thing of where, hey, you can actually get AI to accomplish the task for you. And by the way, that consumes a lot of tokens, but now you can all of a sudden assign like economic value. And you can think of all these things you could do, right? People were using it to trade stocks or whatever. Then the model providers got really excited. It's like, oh, I can probably charge people for this, and they're using a lot of tokens. So, I'm going to make it really easy for people to install this, and make it really easy to distribute. And it just kind of took off from there. But to be very honest, I think, number one, don't have that much talk about it anymore because it is not that easy, right? As easy as it is relative to how it was, 2 years ago, for the average person, it's still a little inaccessible, and it is, still requires you to spend some money. So it's really still for the super, super self-motivated, right? I don't think that even with the quote unquote OpenClaw craze in China, I don't think it penetrated society much more than it did in Silicon Valley. And by the way, in Silicon Valley, like plenty of people around me, even some people working in tech, didn't have an agent framework set up. So, so it wasn't, you know, I would say the smoke was a lot more than the actual fire.
I should have asked this question back when we were talking about DeepSeek and Huawei, but where do the US export controls on chips stand right now? And are those quote unquote restrictions, not putting those words in your mouth, but assuming that's what we're talking about, are they working as intended from Washington's perspective? And how are Chinese companies adapting?
Well, they're not working as intended because I don't think they were ever truly going to work. It's very difficult to cut off China from just all semiconductors in general. I think, though, there's definitely argument to be made that by having such, by making like a player, such a pivotal player like NVIDIA, right, basically inaccessible to the Chinese market, you kind of created more urgency and more of a ready market in China because the demand didn't go away, right? You just cut off the supply. And when there isn't any diminishing in the demand, then people are just going to find alternative ways. And in this case, there were already players who'd been working on semiconductors in China. They just didn't have the capital, talent, and most importantly, they didn't have the customers to realize their vision. And sure, it takes iterations and it takes time and it's a very complex stack. But now we see that, like I said, we see the first model that's being trained on Chinese produced domestic AI chips. That's really, really, I think, a lot faster than what people expected. Even 2 years ago, less than 3 years ago, Chinese, you know, industry experts got together. I remember there's this very widely reported closed-door session, and they were like, China is at least 2 years behind on models. And then for semiconductors, we don't even need to talk about the gap because it seems insurmountable. You know, I think they were being somewhat modest, but, you know, most people gave it at least like a 5 to 10 year gap. And now, I don't know, it's hard to say. Like, sure, the chips individually are nowhere near NVIDIA quality, but if the models being produced, right, are near the model quality, does it really matter? Like what the individual, you know, specs on the chips are? Because you really care about the entire output, right? The entire ecosystem. What is the actual value created?
I mean, unless it's a race to space or something, close is good enough. 95% of applications. So, but that's the risk. That's the risk when you play that game. If you starve people long enough, they figure out how to grow their own food, and now you've lost them, and you hold no power over them. So,
I would argue though, China was always going to get there. Again, it might have been accelerated, but it was not like. I mean, China is a big country with lots of talent and a lot of the supply chain, not the entire supply chain, obviously, but pieces of the supply chain. And what if, you know, it was just not a realistic, I just don't think it was realistic to say that China was never going to have its own semiconductor industry. It's just that 2026 domestically trained chips producing a trillion per hour model. That's probably faster than what, that's certainly faster than what I expected. That's faster than I think what many people would have expected.
Yeah. Well, in 2030, when we're having your gold jacket episode, I'm sure this conversation will be very different. Now, zooming out to the broader US-China AI competition, talk to us. Where do you see both sides? Who's winning? Who's losing? What does the talent landscape look like there? Is the gap widening, narrowing, or am I even framing this correctly?
There is a prevailing narrative that it's like China's going after diffusion, right? How quickly it's diffusing throughout the economy. And then for the US, it's about getting to the mythical, right? ASI, artificial superintelligence.
The singularity?
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever people are calling it now, but effectively this like recursively self-improving super intelligence that, you know.
Well, yeah, that's different. Singularity is, I think, artificial intelligence And speed and processing power matches brain.
Oh, okay. So this is probably beyond that, right? I mean, there are people who argue that right now we've already kind of exceeded the individual human brain. We just haven't exceeded all of, you know, human intelligence, period. Yeah. That's the prevailing narrative. I think that's useful. I personally think, though, especially if you're taking like an investment lens, right? If you care about like how it's impacting the markets or what people are going to spend money on, right now it is still a more powerful model, right? So because the models are still showing kind of step functions in gain in what they can do from quarter to quarter. So in that sense, yeah, you still have the US models being in the lead. You know, how commanding is that lead? Is it 3 months, 6 months, 9 months? It varies depending on who you talk to, but it's certainly less than a year now. Whether or not that lead will expand or contract, I think has a lot of other factors that, again, I can give you my personal opinion. I think that the lead will contract because of the fact that, like, now, you know, like I was saying earlier, China has a much more complete stack. It's more of an engineering problem, blah blah blah. All these reasons. But you know, I think the U.S. is still leading in one thing that is extremely difficult to replicate, and that is money. I think like the financialization of our markets, the willingness to pay, the deep pockets of the corporations here, that's the main advantage I see that China just simply does not have and cannot make up with talent.
Would that even translate culturally to just, let's just say it this way, Americans and those with money and that have deep pockets have a different relationship with money and culture than Chinese do? This is my money. I'm going to keep it. They're less willing to part, invest, risk.
Yeah, it's also access to credit, right? Like, you know, I have to keep my business cash flow alive because I don't have whatever lines of credit I can just call upon. You know, if you go bankrupt in China, you have to pay it back. Right?
Yeah. I mean, there's no insurance for that. There's no TransUnion, TransCredit. You know, there's no app that is monitoring your credit score.
Yeah, but like basically bankruptcy laws are much harsher, right? So therefore, the cost of failure is much higher. And, you know, like I said, access to credit, cost of failure, these things alone make people more risk averse to leverage, to spending beyond what they don't have. And then also deflationary economy, right? All these reasons. Yeah, I think
history.
The U.S. Yeah, you just have to think about like even if these models, right, like quote unquote win on benchmarks or even on your own specific task, what do you really care about, right? And I would argue most of us, right, unless you're working in the space, what you really care about is it one going to affect your job, and two, is it something you can personally benefit from as a personal investor in your stock portfolio, right? These are only two things that really matter. And at least for the second, so the first one I can't answer for you because it's really dependent on your industry. But for the second one, right now, at least, it's in the US.
Do you think that AI use cases advantages the quality of life it can bring, the time in your life it can give you back, is better positioned for the privileged?
You mean like if you are already
the more money you have, the better quality of life you have, the more AI can benefit you because of the way you live and the way you, not just the quality of life, but the way you live your life, the way you operate daily, whether it's work, it's family, it's shopping, it's what have you. I think if you have better privilege, in a lot of different areas. AI can dramatically improve your life or improve the efficiency of your life versus those that are lower income, or, you know, even looking in China, first tier city versus fourth tier city, greater impact for those that live in a first tier city.
I think in the immediate future, yes.
Yeah, right now.
If you're saying right now, because it is primarily helping white collar workers, right? Like I haven't made a PowerPoint, like an actual slide deck, in, you know, at least 6 months, because AI can make it, right? Why do I need to make it?
I need to know what AI you're using, because I've tried and it was butchered.
Oh, just use Claude. That's probably the best output right now, but there are plenty of other,
Well, ChatGPT is terrible, so don't use that.
So I think, like, basically, you know, it really depends on your work, but you really do see people able to run their own businesses now, you know, with AI agents, right? Like, if you were running your own e-commerce business, it really can be a one-person company right now, because so much of the software is already smart enough and cheap enough to for you to, like, run a business entirely on your own. Whereas previously you probably did need customer support. You probably did need, you know, marketing, but now much cheaper agents can take care of it. But yeah, again, how ultimately it you can immediately plug and play into your own life, I think it does depend heavily on, yeah, the type of business, the type of work you do. And sure, if you are a, you know, if you're a delivery worker or if you're a cook or something, it's not going to immediately help you.
Well, that was the least scientific and data back conversation of the podcast. So for you data heads, I apologize for the last 5 minutes. We just went off the rails a little bit, which I want to do. One final thing. This is just going to be open-ended, just some broader takeaways from all of your trips recently to China. Just talk to me about what you think, what you see, what you've experienced or felt. You know, there was the debate in April about high quality of life in lower tier Chinese cities, for example. I'm just curious what your thoughts are from the time that you've spent with your boots on the ground there.
Yeah, I would say that I would agree there's probably a higher quality of life, if you're defining higher quality of life as just having more disposable income, less working hours, you know, a more easy commute because there's less congestion, and mainly, like, yeah, a little cheaper real estate prices. But that goes everywhere, right? For even in the US, it's the same. If you move out of the super congested metros, you would probably be able to find, assuming you can keep up the same level of income, moving to a lower cost of living area would make most people's lives significantly easier. But I think, like, my takeaway from China, to be honest, is that it's very similar. It's very similar to the US. People are worried about AI. People are worried new grads can't find jobs. And that's the same in both US and China. That being said, sometimes I have tried to hire interns on both sides of the Pacific. And some of it I do think is a little bit people feeling like they're entitled to a certain type of job, you know. So there's a lot of people, the social issues are really the same. People don't want to get married. People spending tons of time online with virtual worlds with digital avatars and, you know, online personalities, parasocial relationships, not wanting to have kids. It's really all the same.
Well, all of my fellow Gen Xers just stood up and applauded. When you said that that the young people today are quite entitled, it's funny because I certainly think so as well. You know, I hired a kid who was 19 who was working at a fast food place, you know, basically flipping burgers, and he'd been there for 3 years. And I brought him in and told him I could give him a professional path. He's just got to work hard and learn. And a year later, threw a tantrum because he was tired of being our shop BITCH, because he was tired of having to sweep floors. And I'm like, you're 20, no education, no skills. And here you are throwing a tantrum because I'm, you know, paying you an otherworldly amount of money to kind of, you know, once a week, spend a few hours cleaning up the shop. And, you know, just like that in a nutshell to me was just, this is what we're dealing with these days.
I totally agree with you. It's like, I understand that there are, you know, fewer opportunities. They're very competitive, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I feel like, you know, back when I was a kid and, you know, I graduated right after the dot-com bust. So there were not a lot of jobs. I don't have that much choice. I'm just excited to get an offer. I mean, granted, my offer was with a large company and, you know, it looked whatever, respectable on paper. But I think in today's society, maybe it's just because I'm older, I almost feel like, yeah, go with the small shop that's going to apprentice you, right? And really teach you real skills and would hurt if they had to lay you off versus why are you looking for like the Fortune 500 company that hires in cohorts and is just going to have a very steady attrition rate. But hey, no, maybe not. Maybe when I was 20, I also cared about what my business card and email.
Be hungry. Be willing to hustle and be willing to work hard. It's too bad because it really is just that simple right now. And take the entrepreneur approach. Listen to what people our age are complaining about people that are your age and see that there is a tremendous opportunity, so much low-hanging fruit. It does not take much to differentiate yourself by 2, 3, 4 standard deviations from in the bell curve, and then you can win. Quit your bitching. Get to work.
Youth is wasted on the young. That's what I, that's what.
Well, it was on us too.
Yeah. So, therefore, yeah.
It is always wasted on the young.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. We need more of a Benjamin Buttons type of lifestyle. I don't know if that's a movie reference that you even understand.
No, I know.
You know it?
Yeah.
Okay, not a lot of people. Anyway, Ray, thank you once again for your time, your wisdom, your thoughts, your amazing personality for coming on the show today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Todd. Hope everything is great.
Everything is wonderful. Everything is awesome. And so are you, and so are our listeners. Thank you very much for tuning in, everybody. Please, again, as I always suggest, please like, subscribe, do all the things that we all hate doing. It's just because of the algorithms, and we all know what that does. So the more of you that like us or say something nice, it really helps everybody else out. If you have anything to say, if you have any questions, if you have any guest recommendations, anything like that, you can always reach us at podcast@wpic.co. That's it for now from me, from Ray, and from everybody at the negotiation team. Thanks very much for listening and or watching, and we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.